Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the City Recital Hall Angel Place. I should begin by saying I have a little bit of bad news for all of you. I've had a phone call from Wayne Swan. He's not pleased that we're not watching him deliver the budget speech. Names have been taken, 2% extra on everybody's tax who came to the debate tonight. On behalf of John Rothney Jones, the St James Ethics Centre, the City of Sydney, the Sydney Morning Herald and the ABC, I'd like to welcome you here tonight for the fourth debate in this year's series. I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, on whose country we meet, and personally to pay my respect to their elders, past and present. My name is Simon Longstaff. I'm the Executive Director of St James Ethics Centre and delighted to chair tonight's debate. I should mention to you that the proceedings are being recorded by ABC Television and Radio for subsequent broadcast, and for those of you who are interested when that will happen, I'll mention it towards the end of the debate. Basic rules for tonight, as is the case on each occasion, we encourage a passionate engagement around the ideas, but a respectful engagement in dealing with each of the people who are speaking. That's not just for our speakers on the stage, but as you know, later on in proceedings there's an opportunity to participate in the floor debate, and the same expectation exists there. Now, you may have noticed just behind your right or left shoulder a voting ticket. It's got two parts, a part for or against. If you are obviously in favour of the affirmative, you go vote for, you can vote against. But if you're still undecided at the end of the debate, and I really hope that none of you are by then you can vote by keeping the ticket still joined together when the ballot box comes around. The form of tonight's debate is as outlined in the order paper which you should have received when you entered. The topic, of course, is that governments should not censor the internet. Now, let me introduce our speakers. I'm going to introduce them as a group on the affirmative and then a group on the negative, and I'd ask you to welcome them all as I've concluded that. Ross Lajeunesse is Head of Public Policy and Government Affairs for Google in Asia. He oversees the company's relationships with governments and policymakers throughout the Asia-Pacific region and advises Google on data security, internet privacy, free speech and numerous other issues affecting the company's operations and products. Before joining Google, Ross served as Deputy Chief of Staff and Senior Advisor to California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. David Marr has spent the last 35 years reporting for Fairfax, broadcasting for the ABC, and writing books. He came to journalism after first training as a lawyer. He then joined the Sydney Morning Herald, where he continues to write on politics, the law, media and the arts. David Marr presented Media Watch from 2002 to 2004. Last year he published The Henson Case, a forensic analysis of the most bitter art controversy of the last 50 years. And he's joined by Anthony Lowenstein, a Sydney-based independent freelance journalist, author and blogger. He's the author of a book on the Israel-Palestine conflict, My Israel Question, and is a board member of Macquarie University's Centre for Middle East and North African Studies. He's an honorary associate at Macquarie University's Department of Politics and International Relations and co-founder of advocacy group Independent Australian Jewish Voices. He contributed to Amnesty International's 2008 report about Chinese internet repression and the Beijing Olympic Games. He's the author of The Blogging Revolution, a revelatory account of bloggers around the globe who live and write under repressive regimes, many of them risking their lives in doing so. Would you please welcome them all? Leading the argument for the negative is Kaiser Kuo, a Beijing-based columnist and commentator on technology and politics. He currently serves as consultant for international business and does media relations for Youku.com, China's leading internet video site. He's a musician and was co-founder of China's most successful heavy metal band, Tang Dynasty. A frequent guest on China Central Television, speaks frequently on topics related to the Chinese internet. Kaiser graduated in political science from the University of California, Berkeley, and has an MA in East Asian Studies from the University of Arizona. He's presently writing a book about the impact of the internet on US-China relations. He's joined by Alistair McGibbon, founder of the Internet Safety Institute and managing partner of internet consultancy Shorte Group. Did I get that right?
Almost.
Prior to that, I was going to do it with a French accent. I'm sure it was going to be wrong. Prior to that, Alistair headed trust and safety at eBay Australia and later eBay Asia Pacific. He was the founding director of the Australian High-Tech Crime Centre, a law enforcement unit hosted by the Australian Federal Police to coordinate Australia's efforts to combating serious crime involving technology. He was a federal agent with the Australian Federal Police for 15 years. And finally, Elizabeth Hansley, Professor, Associate Dean of Law at Flinders University in Adelaide. She's a specialist in media law as it affects children. She's Vice President of the Australian Council on Children and the Media, co-convener of the Harvard Australia Symposium on Media Use and the Children's Wellbeing. Elizabeth has also published on contempt, defamation and sedition law, has two daughters aged 16 and 11. Would you please welcome the speakers for the negative? Ladies and gentlemen, the proposition before this House is that governments should not censor the internet. I invite Ross Lajeunesse to address the House with his arguments for the affirmative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's terrific to be here tonight to join this important debate. Freedom of expression is a wonderful thing. My colleagues and I will argue that governments should not censor the internet. I'll discuss what makes the internet so unique as a communications medium, the power and promise that the internet holds because of its open, distributed nature, and the view that Google takes in this debate. My colleague David Marr will discuss the particular debate occurring here in Australia, and my colleague Anthony Lowenstein will give us a sense of how this debate fits into global trends and issues around censorship of the internet. Today, 4 in 5 Australians have an internet service at home. The number of internet users around the world is almost 2 billion, and there are over 1 trillion web pages on the internet. The numbers are impressive and growing all the time. Now, the internet is not only vast, but it's dynamic. In fact, by the time I finish speaking, the internet will already look much different than it does right now, because in 9 minutes, 216 additional hours of video will be uploaded to YouTube. The world will write 500,000 new tweets, and 2.5 million words will be added to Blogger. So how did we get to this remarkable reality? The origins of the internet begin back in the 1960s when the United States funded research to build fault-tolerant and distributed computer networks. In other words, the internet was designed and built to span international borders and to avoid any single country's governance. By design, there are no country codes in IP addressing structures. There are no central governing bodies. The only thing that counts is which networks connect to which networks. And the internet was also designed to be open. And by open, I mean that anyone can upload content and communicate with other internet users. Again, there is no central controller nor curator. You don't need to ask permission to publish your opinions. You don't need to ask permission to read the opinions of others. You don't need permission to communicate with your fellow Australians or others around the world, or to do research, or to start a business online, as countless people have done. And therein lies the true power of the internet. The fact that you don't need anyone else's permission to use it or access it. To illustrate the open nature of the internet, I think about what doing schoolwork or research was like when I was a kid. I grew up in a very small town in the northeastern United States, and if I wanted to do a report or learn about Australia, for example, my options and opportunities for knowledge were pretty limited. You know, the first step would be I'd refer to the family set of the encyclopedia, which was already a couple years old by the time I went to it. And if I was lucky, There'd be three or four pages about Australia and maybe, you know, a couple black and white photos of very stereotypical things like surfers at Bondi Beach or maybe a koala bear or something like that. And beyond that, I could ask my mother to take me to the local library where perhaps the options were only slightly better. Or maybe I'd have a pen pal, if any of you remember what those were, where we would, you know, trade letters once a month and get something back, and that was pretty much it. I wouldn't have a very well-developed understanding of Australia. My learning and my understanding of the world in general were extremely limited. Now think of a child today. Now within seconds, she has up-to-the-minute news reports from Australia. She can access the most current research and information on everything from this evening's budget speech to news archives of the Sydney Morning Herald, dating back to the 1800s. She can read essays and articles from Australia's thought and opinion leaders, some of whom are on this stage tonight. She can use Street View to drive through the streets of Sydney and see the city. And she can go to the websites of museums and actually see their collections. She can email Mr. Rudd directly and ask him why his government thinks an ISP filter is a good idea. And maybe she would hear back. She can access all of this information because the internet is open. There is no curator, no librarian, no gatekeeper, no one controlling who gets in and what they see, and that's the way it should be. Similarly, as a child, I think about my ability to speak to the world and how limited that was. If I had something to say, I could speak to my parents or my friends at school, and if I were really motivated, maybe I would write a letter to the editor. And maybe that editor would publish it if he or she deemed it appropriate. Now today, things are much different. My ideas, your ideas, anyone's ideas, are much more easily distributed. There are blogs, YouTube, any number of sites on which you can post commentary. And if those ideas are interesting enough, then they are seen by thousands, sometimes millions of people. And again, no one has to decide if my ideas or your ideas are good enough to be communicated. We don't need an editor or a TV producer, a media mogul, or a government official to decide if our ideas are good enough to get out to the rest of the world. The ideas themselves determine how powerful they are. Now, this global, distributed, and open structure sets the internet apart from every other media and communications network. It has triggered avalanches of innovation and economic growth. Skype, eBay, iTunes, Amazon, it has kept governments, it has kept institutions and companies accountable, and it enables people to break through barriers, from Barack Obama to Susan Boyle. Now, with these fundamental characteristics, the internet has evolved into a globe-spanning platform of communications, ideas, business, information sharing, used by one in four people around the world and growing faster than any other form of communication ever has. And we would not have had this growth if governments had looked to control the internet at its inception. So not everyone is quite so positive about the liberating power of the internet or believes in such open access to information. Many governments find this openness and this easy access to information very threatening. What makes the internet so extremely powerful is exactly what makes it so dangerous in the eyes of some governments, especially those governments who have grown accustomed to controlling other forms of media, and which now want to control the internet as well. So the battle is truly on. And if we're not careful, and if we don't push back against this worrying trend, we may end up with an internet which is much different than the one we currently enjoy today. We may end up with an internet that is a series of national walled gardens, where each is controlled by that nation's government with different rules, and in which each government decides which types of trees and plants get to live in that garden and which don't. where each plant is even carefully selected, placed, and then pruned as necessary by that government/gardener, and where that government/gardener has the right and ability to keep the weeds out. I don't think that the majority of Australians believe that this is an internet that they want for their country or for the world. Thank you very much.
Kaiser Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Ross. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I guess the plan was to get the irksome American accents out of the way as quickly as possible. Some of you may be assuming that because I live in China, I intend to be up here defending China's policies of internet censorship. I want to disabuse you of that notion immediately. I absolutely do not intend to defend China's policies of internet censorship. I am opposed to political internet censorship, particularly the way that it's practiced in China. I find it intrinsically objectionable, and I sincerely hope that one day we may live in a world that is free of political internet censorship. My instinct is to oppose curbs on those precious freedoms that we enjoy in societies, especially with long traditions of political freedom, freedom of expression, societies like Australia. Now, I am not familiar enough with CleanFeed, with the Rudd government's proposed mandatory internet filtering, to really take a stand on this, but I'm inclined to believe that, knowing myself well, that if the debate were actually in fact about the proposals now on the books, I might find myself sitting on this side. But that is not what this debate is about. This debate is the proposal here is that governments should not censor the internet, not the Rudd government's proposed internet filtering law should not be passed. And for this debate, then, I am compelled to argue that not all governments ought to restrain or to refrain from internet censorship, not certainly in all instances. This is something I believe most reasonable people will accept. All we need to do is convince you that in some instances, internet censorship is an evil, a necessary evil, and I believe we should have your vote. I hold that freedom of expression or of information is a value to which all people aspire. It's a desired end state, but the realities of history, the diverse historical experiences that all these peoples on Earth have had, it's handed people a very different set of values. It's constrained the way that we can move toward that end state without at least tearing the fabric of society. I accept, then, as anyone with any knowledge of history really certainly must, that we live in a world with widely disparate economic realities, habits of mind, political cultures, all rooted in history. History has conditioned the way that societies set their priorities, the roles that governments play. My position is then that internet censorship is an evil but a necessary evil. And I hope that I'm able to convince you of that here this evening. The reality is that in spite of what Ross Lajeunesse just tried to tell you, these optical cables cross borders. The servers and the routers live in sovereign territory. Nation states are not all the same, and nor will the laws that they create around the internet be the same. We cannot expect naively that they all will be. We must not think of the internet as something that simply sits above all the petty frays of nation states. That's not reality. I think it can be reasonably argued that in countries with no tradition whatsoever of pluralistic politics, no tradition of civil society or of a public sphere, no historical experience of political participation at the popular level, any kind of a sudden thrust toward Western political norms like democracy and freedom of speech can yield truly catastrophic results, turning people against these noble ideas. We really need no further than Afghanistan or Iran to see instances in which the perceived foisting of such values on people has resulted in something I think we would all agree is less than a perfect democratic idea. People cannot be changed overnight. These political cultures have inertia. They possess real inertia. The ideas that I so cherish that are enshrined in the Bill of Rights, they were themselves the expression of a political philosophy with very deep historical roots. They're the fruit of the European Enlightenment. They trace a lineage, a very long lineage, from political ideas that were gestating in England from the time of the Magna Carta, traditions of Anglo-jurisprudence with equally deep roots, of ideas that were very radical for their time, the ideas that animated the Protestant Reformation, of the rekindling of interest in classical antiquity that animated the Renaissance, and of course, of the very classical ideas of Athens itself. These are very, very deep, very, very distant ideas. The distilled essence of these traditions, the core ideas of the West's liberal democratic culture, are marvelous, they're unquestionably noble, and I personally hope that they do one day attain a kind of universality. But we must not forget that they are the product of a unique, exceptional historical experience. Time, technology, and size all really do matter. When, in 1791, the principle of freedom of speech was really enshrined for the first time in the First Amendment to the American Constitution, the world's information environment was radically different from what it is right now. How fast did information actually travel? At the speed of a galloping horse. What were literacy rates back then, even in the most advanced nations on Earth? It was really still the preserve of a small, male, educated elite. Fast forward now to a country like China today, where there are 404 million internet users, twice that number of people who are carrying around with them in their pockets right now a device capable of sending text, a voice, even perhaps pictures or video around the country, around the world, nearly instantaneously. There is a lot more water behind the proverbial floodgates, as it were, than there was in the U.S. in 1791. And in this context, gradualism is a sensible approach. Censorship of the internet in China has, make no mistake, gotten worse in recent years. It's very arbitrary. It lacks transparency. And I think that there is no reasonable explanation for doing what they're doing. And I do believe, as so many other of my Chinese friends believe, that the internet must be considerably more free, must be considerably more liberated than it is. But I, again, like many of my Chinese friends, find that gradualism makes more sense than a sudden unleashing of the water behind the floodgates. China has never had a political culture where debate and open exchange of ideas were the norm. China's internet, however circumscribed, is now functioning as a de facto public sphere, and in its relatively short life has already palpably begun to transform the political landscape of China. The internet has been disruptive, not just technologically, but culturally, socially, and indeed politically. Rightly or wrongly, this disruption makes many Chinese people very nervous. That's true in large part because so many Chinese alive today have a vivid living memory of the horrors of the Cultural Revolution. The madness, the chaos, the lawlessness, and the abject violence. While we in the West chalk up that catastrophe typically to an excess of authoritarianism, an excess of totalitarianism, in fact, you ask Chinese about it, and they'll tell you that it was because of a lack of control, not a surfeit of it. Fear of chaos and desire for stability are very deep-rooted ideas in China. In America, I was brought up believing that, as Benjamin Franklin famously said, those who would give up essential liberty to purchase temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. And yet, I fully understand, even while it frustrates me, why it would be that so many Chinese make that trade and make it happily. I understand why they would prioritize basic dignity and the historically unprecedented economic and personal liberties that they now enjoy over the higher order political liberties, these things that most people believe are to be had by the more developed countries. These are higher order liberties. China isn't the only country where the value of free speech online, even political speech, must be sometimes subordinated to realities. India's internet censorship is a much less well-known case than China's, and certainly far less onerous, but as a democracy with an essentially free press, India is an example that probably makes the case for the necessity of internet censorship more clear. Google famously pulled its internet search business out of China, in part because it could no longer stomach China's increasingly stringent censorship demands. But Google routinely bows to pressure from New Delhi when it comes to India. Its social network, Orkut, which is very popular in India, is routinely censored by Google. Much of this speech is political, but it's genuinely innocuous by American or Australian standards, and yet Google routinely censors it. Google's deputy legal counsel, Nicole Wong, told the Wall Street Journal, "In those gray areas, it is really hard. On the one hand, we do believe very strongly in political speech, and on the other, in India, they do riot and blow up buses." Thank you very much.
David Marr.
Imagine the scene a year from now in the House of Representatives. It's question time. Kevin Rudd is the Prime Minister, because he will still be the Prime Minister. And let us suppose for a moment that Tony Abbott is still the Leader of the Opposition. And Tony Abbott unrolls a hideous screenshot of carnal action. Right? The internet filter is all bedded down, it's all in place, all's there, the scheme is operating. And Tony Abbott comes into the House of Representatives, rolled up, and then unrolls with a flourish a screenshot of a hideous sexual act going on and says to the Prime Minister, "How can you allow this on the internet? You have the power to stop it, the machinery is there, why aren't you stopping it? How can you expose the community and children to this?" And he holds it up. And the Prime Minister will say, "Because it doesn't fall into the classification we're banning." And Tony Abbott will say, "Well, why isn't it banned? It's disgusting, and it's there because you are allowing it to be there." And he can come into the House day after day, week after week, with trashy screenshots taken from some of the most hideous areas of the internet, which are, in fact, lawfully screened, and he can say, how is your government allowing this? Because the minute you have the power to filter the internet, you are responsible for everything that is there. And you wonder, why would a government do this? Well, first, it's important to understand it's being done because Rudd wants it done. There are no freelancers in his cabinet. Stephen Conroy is doing what the Prime Minister wants him to do. Kevin Rudd has cleared the decks for the election. He has cleared the decks of any attempt to deal with global warming. He has abandoned casually plans for a Charter of Rights, but he is ploughing on with the filter. This is something he will spend political capital on. And you only had to look at the hands going up on Q&A last night to understand that this is going to take political capital to bed down. And he is going to do it because it is about children, because it's about vulnerable children, and because in the handful of issues that really matter to Kevin Rudd, protecting vulnerable children is one of them. And that is because he was a vulnerable child. David Marr's quarterly essay on the subject, soon to come out, will explain some of these things. This is why he dived into the Henson debate and declared those pictures absolutely revolting. It is about protecting children. It really is about protecting children. Decent people and decent governments do all they can to protect children. But they have to protect real children and offer real protection from real danger. The problem with the plans to mandatorily filter the internet is, though the children are real, undoubtedly real, the protection is illusory and the danger is exaggerated. It is suggested by the proponents of the filter that without the filter, we are somehow defenceless. This is rubbish. At the time I was writing that little Henson book about the extraordinary panic that swept Australia at that time, I had the opportunity to meet and talk to the AFP officers who run the policing of the internet for things like child porn. And at exactly the time the Henson thing blew up, they were bringing in one of the most important operations they had done in suppressing and punishing those who deal in child porn. It was called Operation Centurion. It led to hundreds of arrests around the world and 50 or 60 arrests in Australia. It led to the rescue of children from bondage in Australia. It was a remarkable and a successful operation. The officers involved in Operation Centurion had had to leave their work for a few days in order to look at the Hensons owned by the National Gallery in Canberra. The police were ropeable about this waste of their time, completely ropeable. Now, they work very well policing the internet. In New South Wales, if you are found to be making or disseminating or holding, possessing child pornography, you can go to jail for 10 years. Now, a charge involving child pornography does not just involve a jail sentence. The conviction on a charge of child pornography shreds your life. You have nothing remotely like a reputation left. Murder is one thing. Honestly, in this town, you can overcome a reputation for having perhaps a hot-blooded moment when you were young, murdered somebody or maybe a couple of people. But a conviction on any child pornography charge is the end of you as a civil person, as a civic person. You are done for. You all remember the fate of Patrick Power, a senior barrister in this town, one of the senior prosecutors for the Director of Public Prosecutions. He was found to have a swamp of apparently hideous child pornography on the hard drive of his private website. A private computer. He went to jail for 8 months, he emerged a completely shredded human being. The internet is policed for child pornography, and those who are caught are extremely strongly punished. We are not defenceless without a filter. We simply are not. I'm not sure that I would be here tonight if this was a plan by the government, tightly focused on removing from the internet child pornography. I would perhaps be arguing that there's a danger with such plans, that having established the machinery to censor one thing on the internet, a government at some time further down the track might be tempted to censor more. The unique thing about the Australian plan is that bracket creep is built in. It is there from the start. This is not just about child pornography. It is about the whole category, which now has the rather unfortunately ambiguous initials RC. Now, there may be some people in this audience, roughly my age, who think RC refers to Roman Catholic. No, it is not. There is no plan here at the moment to ban the works of the Catholic Church. The RC stands for refused classification, and it is not a small category in this country. It is a very idiosyncratic category. And everything falling into RC, let's put to one side the hilarious proposition that the small team of people in Surrey Hills who make the classifications are going to be capable of classifying the whole of the world's internet. There isn't, as I understand it, the manpower to classify what has happened in the 36 minutes so far. What is proposed to be banned in this country will be, by the internet filtering, will be computer games for adults, which are banned in this country. We are a unique country, the world. We ban computer games for adults. Salo, that old film, has just recently been released, so it's not going to be banned. Anything about methods for euthanasia, of course, will be banned. And I can imagine at some stage Tony Abbott coming into the House of Representatives and saying, look, here's a picture of people... Oh, I was going to say smoking. No, because, of course, the Liberal Party took $200,000 from British American Tobacco and Philip Morris last year. So he wouldn't be... But maybe he would want, say, dope smoking banned by a filter. This is a tremendously bad idea. We can deal with this without the government taking the power to decide what we can and cannot see using secret lists to determine it. We can do it without that. And while we can do it without that, we must. There is no sense in us handing the government this kind of machinery with an impact on our lives.
McGibbon.
The internet is a reflection of society. It's a reflection of both the good and the bad. Just like in the offline world, online we find good and bad people. I think what shocks people most on the internet is that amongst all of the good things, amongst the creativity and the trade, amongst all of those things that we hold so dear about the internet, is just how much bad there can be as well. Ask any police officer working child sex crimes whether they're shocked and appalled and possibly even a little bit disheartened about the volume of child sex abuse they see occurring online. Are they disheartened by the huge number of child sex images that a child sex offender can amass online and the speed with which an offender will hone in on their potential victim for them to carry out their highly illegal sexual fantasies? Real children, real victims, and real danger. Ask any educator if they're now worried about the amount of cyberbullying that their students are partaking in. Real devastation caused by virtual harassment. Real crime. Real damage. According to credible IT security companies, up to 97% of all of the email that flies through the ether today is spam. Spam telling me that I can find love, spam telling me I can have a larger penis, spam telling me I can also grow breasts, get rich from Nigerian oil, and my favourite, regain my hair. Now, at the end of the debate, I'm asking Kaiser where he goes for his online pharmaceuticals. It seems to me, obviously the internet's doing fine. But look, the internet is a reflection of what we're doing. It's not something over there. It's not something virtual. The internet is us. And the internet is what we do in business. The internet is what we do at home. And indeed, the number one way in which Australians now engage our government is online. Ladies and gentlemen, the debate tonight is whether the internet is some type of virtual utopia that needs to be carved off from the rest of society and sat on a pillar and protected against government and any form of social regulation, or it's a useful tool that we, flawed people, use that requires some form of social control, some form of predictability. I am defending the notion of the Australian government having some role in determining access to very tightly defined segments of information by Australians. But to argue that the Australian government has some role to play does not mean that the Australian government has a large role to play. In fact, I know that my fellow negative side would say that the individual has the largest role in determining what they do online and what they consume. But the government has some role. I should also add that it's improper to imply that because we say the government has some role in determining what we might be able to consume in terms of media, that we are supporters of the current Australian government proposal for clean feed. It would be improper and wrong. In fact, it would be a distortion of what this debate is about. I, for one, am not a supporter. It will not work. But I do believe in the right of governments to help determine some of the ways in which we can consume media. The basis of my argument is that the internet is not a gimmick. We talk about surfing the web like it's some holiday function that we do. The very name surfing implies it's recreational. We need to change that name or the word so that we can talk about the importance of this. Most of us run very important businesses and private lives now using the internet. We keep in touch with friends and family. We make new friends online. These things are important to us. So it's vital that the internet is robust. It's vital that we have a degree of predictability to it. And there are many reasons why we find this hard. Jurisdiction has already been mentioned by the other side. But the number one reason why it's hard is the concept of anonymity. The internet is one big psychological experiment for what psychologists called de-individuation. And that's where the situation allows you to somehow lose your social and ethical control around you. Your moral codes recede. And if you remember the social experiments of the 50s and 60s and 70s of whether people would electrocute people or torture people more if they weren't identified, welcome to the internet, where the anonymity allows people to do things that they may not otherwise do. So they don't quite feel that their actions have the same weight online. It's virtual. Tell that to a victim of crime online. The other side in this debate would have you think that the government is evil. Well, at least it's a bit malignant and its intentions aren't pure. David was very eloquent in saying that, that it's political why the government's doing this. So the government should vacate the field. Let's get the government out of there. Who's left? Corporations. Big corporations and small corporations online. Companies like Google. So we've already been told that there are a trillion pages on the internet, that there are 500 million words added in hours, and there are thousands of hours of YouTube will be added while we speak. Fantastic. No human being can sort it out. So the internet is not about whether there is information out there. That's not what the internet's about now. The internet is now about finding that information, sequencing it, and serving it to us as individual consumers. That's where the real power lies. That's where the real power lies on the internet, and that power now lies with companies like Google. Now, offline, I can't go and borrow books from the local library that portray an old man penetrating a child. I can't go to a local library or to a high street gallery and purchase videos of rape and non-consenting sexual acts. I can't do that offline. And yet I believe I live in a free society. There are laws governing those things offline. The question tonight is really whether or not those laws should apply online. In fact, David did a very good job of showing that those laws do apply online and that enforcement happens today. And a reasonable person would suggest that if you are committing a crime online, that is the same as committing the crime offline. And our argument tonight is not about whether or not there is an internet filter. That's not what this debate is about. The debate is about whether or not the media that we consume offline today is acceptable to us as a society, and whether or not we expect that same level of freedom in the online space. And there's only one real answer to that, and that is that we should have the internet be seen as a tool used by us to access information. So what about Google and the way in which it indexes the world's information? So their actual stated aim is to organise the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. But as I said, our heads would explode. So instead, Google now chooses which information will survive and which information won't. If you're not top of the fold, your information will die. Who here goes past the fifth page in any Google search? Google determines now the information that we consume. No one elected them. They're largely offshore and beyond our laws. They have no FOI. They have a secret code that makes them tens of billions of dollars a year. Controlling that very information. Different to a government that we elect? Let me read you a quick list put together by Reporters Without Borders. Borders Without Borders would be much better. Reporters Without Borders. China, Cuba, Iran, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Turkmenistan, Vietnam, Australia, and Yemen. Now, if I was sitting NAPLAN today and asked which was the odd one out, I would choose Australia. Let's not allow the fact that someone puts us on the list of axis of evil to be treated as if we somehow, Australians that we are somehow the same as those other governments. This debate is about whether or not the Australian government has a role in order to control some of the information we consume. Thank you.
just might point out there are at least two people's hands who go past page 5 on Google.
Oh, really? I'll meet you after.
Anthony Lowenstein.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, we live under the illusion that governments can protect us from the evils of the world. Pedophilia, extreme violence, lessons in self-harm, suicide, race, hate, terrorism. And we know since September 11, 2001, there's been an explosion of terror groups, meeting and organising online to plan mass carnage. We seem helpless to stop it. We look to governments and security authorities to target the weak, the motivated and the deadly. We rarely seem to ask why growing numbers of Muslims hate us and want us dead. We have every right to expect governments to monitor hate and terror sites and arrest and prosecute those who aim to do us harm. But censoring the web will have no effect on insulating us from these horrors. It's a false security, comforting election-style rhetoric to convince fearful parents and scared teachers. And that's just in the West. Having spent time in numerous repressive states such as Cuba, Egypt, Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia and China, there is no indication, that these nations are any better at protecting their citizens from the darkest recesses of the internet or the mind. And millions of users find ways around these filtering services, often provided, I might add, by Western multinationals. Besides, tell me how trying to ban YouTube videos of men kissing or women driving, both illegal acts in the US-backed dictatorship of Saudi Arabia, proves anything other than officials will filter material that suits their political agenda. And who here this evening trusts our government of either political stripe to transparently, and that's the key point, only block content that is harmful to children? Already in Europe, there are debates about banning websites that allegedly endorse terrorism. But who makes this decision? Resistance movements that oppose American and Australian actions in Iraq and Afghanistan, elected Palestinian parties such as Hamas, which are backed by millions of Arabs in much of the world, the powerful Lebanese group Hezbollah, again regarded as a terrorist group by many in the West, but lionised across the Muslim world. We are not far, as David rightly said, in this country from a day when shrieking voices will advocate the filtering of political content that offends certain sensibilities, ethnic groups, racial minorities, or political parties. This does not mean it's good public policy designed to improve social harmony, because censorship, ladies and gentlemen, is always about a form of control. No society has complete freedom of speech, no one. But we should be very, very mindful of any government that tells us filtering will be painful or cost-free. Now, although tools such as Facebook, Twitter, YouTube and others, including mobile phones, are invaluable in connecting dissidents, activists and protesters, and of course we all remember those amazing scenes in Iran last year after the June uprising and false election, authorities in those countries and elsewhere can equally use the same technology to monitor and find perceived enemies. This is censorship on heat, killing any chance of the idea of web utopia. Now, democracy doesn't arrive on the net. Never has, never will. This is a myth. It only comes through people power, with maybe the assistance of the internet. Government censorship merely reinforces the fear of change and shows citizens how afraid dictatorships are of true democracy and public engagement. If anything, it can harm democratic aspirations of the oppressed by giving unprecedented insight into people's private lives and movements. Social ills, despite what you might be told, are not going to be reversed. Take Iran, where heroin addiction is soaring due to its easy accessibility from a chaotic neighbouring Afghanistan. Blocking websites that either celebrate its use or provide information how to find the drug of choice has had no effect on the problem. So Western governments, be warned. The internet is unlike any other medium. Books, films and art can be relatively easily banned. Mass distribution stopped with a flick of a pen. But websites, on the other hand, can move, they can evolve, they can reappear in a different space tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. They're interactive, or Web 2.0 is at least, and allow users to pick and choose their involvement. And of course, compared to that, TV and cinema is a one-way street, visually seductive, but incapable of conversing with the viewer, you and me. Now, respecting the intelligence of a parent to monitor a child's activities is seemingly beyond the capability of many Western states, including Norway, Finland, the UK, Denmark, the Netherlands and New Zealand, nations that have all blocked sites set to contain child pornography, but impacts on limiting access to the obscene material has been very minimal. Now, we on the Affirmative don't oppose schools, teachers, parents implementing their own methods to protect children from harmful content. Who would? But the Rudd Labor government's plan, as David eloquently explained, appears incapable of understanding that imposing a draconian system with no transparency, which is the key point of the argument, only brings suspicion and resistance. And as David rightly said, the debate on Q&A last night was very instructive. People don't like what they don't understand, and they're not being explained by the government what actually is going to happen if this filter happens. Now, in a modest sign of self-policing, something I think is encouraging, Facebook UK recently announced increased online safety after a lot of outcry about Facebook's ability to have stalking and bullying. They included a 24-hour police hotline, an education campaign to manage cyberbullying and stalking. No one says that's enough, no one says that should stop there, but the point is there is some self-policing after a public discussion and dialogue, rather than being told how something should be. Now let's look, for a laugh, but also because it's very serious, at some classic overseas examples. The implementation of internet censorship in Iran is comical. Allow me to explain. Now, if you type the name of former American Vice President Dick Cheney into a search engine there, you'll be blocked from going any further. Dick is a supposedly sexual word for repressed Iranian officials, but Richard Cheney is okay. Teen, oral, cock, Asian and thousands of other words are often banned. Even singer Bruce Springsteen was inaccessible during my visit in 2007 because it contained the word teen. The word woman was also sometimes filtered and is to this day. Queer and wanker, they're fine, but thank God for that. But many gay and transgender sites are often blocked. Unsurprisingly, of course, enterprising individuals are designing software, often coming from the US and Western states, to help bypass these rules. The point being, you can have the most repressive internet censorship system in the world, Iran, China. It is having zero effect on blocking the content the advocates of a filter say should be blocked. Zero effect. Now, the Islamic Republic, of course, is an extreme example. We shouldn't forget, aided and abetted in their censorship by companies such as Nokia and Siemens, who sold a monitoring centre, a major monitoring centre, to Tehran in 2008. But growing numbers of countries see Iran and China as the model of stability. Market freedom, but political repression. The Western liberal democratic state is unappealing to regimes that want to maintain power and shut out dissent. Actions by increasing numbers of Western states, such as our own, by arbitrarily blocking content is simply giving comfort to filterers in Beijing, Tehran, Havana, Cairo. Perhaps it's time all of us in the West said we don't know what we're doing. While internet usage is booming across the world, for example, in the last year alone, more than 21 million Indonesians from fewer than a million 12 months before now use Facebook, making it the world's third biggest Facebook community. Many non-democratic nations are using similar arguments to Western states in monitoring the web. For example, in late April, the UAE announced that the Interior Ministry would check the identity of anyone using the web in public places to fight cybercrime and child pornography. Perhaps Stephen Conroy gave the UAE some talking points. The web is as powerful as its users, and influential as any of us want it to be. It's not infallible, it's not perfect, and any democracy should care what content is available. But, as we argue on the Affirmative, for governments to be trusted to censor content, with the churches riding bareback alongside the ideological cousins, should worry us all. Don't let the fear-mongering get you down. Thank you.
Elizabeth Hansen.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be here with you this evening and to fulfil the enviable role of rounding up this stage of the debate. The main point that we have been trying to develop on the negative side of this debate is not to defend any particular regime. So I would like you to put out of your mind all of the particular examples that you have heard tonight about Australia and overseas, and any particular thing that anyone has suggested might happen. We want you to think about the concept of government accepting a role, some role. Assume it will be an appropriate role. Can you really say there can be no appropriate role for the government in censoring the internet, in regulating the information to which people have access on the internet? Even my colleague here, David Marr, made it very clear that this already happens. It already happens because the police find people who have been posting material that is illegal on the internet. If there is material that is illegal on the internet and people are being arrested and locked up for having that material, that, my friends, is censorship. That is censorship. It's already happening. And even the speakers for the affirmative believe that that's a good thing. So what we're trying to argue here is that we should not dismiss censorship out of hand, that governments should not dismiss censorship out of hand. And in this sense, I hope you'll agree with me that the topic of this debate, that governments should not censor the internet, simply cannot be defended. Now, a lot of the debate about this tends to assume that what's to be censored, if we have any censorship, will be to do with sex and nudity. Maybe some of you have also had occasion to think about hate speech and what goes on in the internet there. I don't want to spend terribly much time on either of those, other than to wonder whether Voltaire would have defended to the death the right of neo-Nazis to push their horrid hate speech, anti-gay speech, anti-Jewish speech and so on out to a huge community over the internet. Voltaire said that he would defend that of which he disapproved. He didn't say that he would defend that which tears at the fabric of society, that by which he's physically revolted, or that which put him in fear for his life. Surely we are mature enough, as my colleague Kaiser explained, surely we're mature enough in Australia to tell the difference between those things. Anyway, I'm not going to go on any more about hate speech or any of that. I'm going to talk about something that I've been doing a lot of research on in the last 5 years, which is food advertising to children. Now, I'm going to preface this by an observation that there aren't terribly many certainties in life, but I think one certainty is that I'm the only person on this stage who has spent 24 hours going on a trip to hell and back to bring another life into the world. Now, that doesn't make me any kind of saint, as you well know, but I believe that it gives one a different view on the value of life. And so I am speaking to you tonight as a mother, as well as an academic. And when I hear Benjamin Franklin trying to tell me that freedom is more important than health or safety or life, I want to ask him, well, how long on that day back in 1706 was your mother in labour? I wonder about Voltaire's mother too. And I'd like not to be writing a letter to her after he's defended those neo-Nazis' right to free speech to his own death. Anyway, I don't want to suggest that Benjamin Franklin was wrong, because sometimes maybe freedom is more important than life. But I think there's a real arrogance in making a statement like that, where you assume that you've got the balance right forever and all time. That it would be folly to fall for an attractive aphorism like that, and that was made in another place and time. To determine the level of protection that we provide to the most vulnerable people in our society, which is our children. And I'm very glad that David Marr raised the question of children, real dangers to real children, because that's what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about the fact that, as you know, food companies have been under pressure to review the way that they advertise to children in recent years. And a couple of years ago, the ACCC made a finding against a food company in relation to a particular snack product and the way that they were marketing it. They were exaggerating the role of fruit in the production of this product, and that was held to be misleading in contravention of Section 52 of the Trade Practices Act. What did they do? Did they change the way that they used the word fruit in their advertising? Well, yeah, they did, but not in the way that you might expect. What they did was they developed a very sophisticated online world full of cute little characters, engaging characters with little biographies that children could identify with, all based on the product. And this online world had a name that began with the letters F-R-U. So they did change the way they used the word fruit. They took half of it and created an online world around it. Most importantly, this online world was full of games and activities that where children could spend hours soaking up that marketing message for that product. So there's no longer any need to make any representations about fruit, because it's much more effective with children to make representations that a product is cool and fun, and to use their loyalty and to develop their loyalty by having them engaged in activities relating to the product for the longest possible time. Now, why is the internet such a bonanza for people who want to sell products to children? Well, I'll quote from the Kaiser Family Foundation's 2006 study, which tells us that the internet is a cost-effective way to deliver a brand message. While the cost to air a television commercial in 2004 ranged from approximately $7 to over $30 per 1,000 viewers, there are no media distribution costs once a website is created. Estimates suggest that when development costs are spread across game players, an advergame, you'll be hearing more of that word, advergame, can cost less than $2 per 1,000 users. So $30 per 1,000 users for a TV ad, $2 per 1,000 users for a website. You do the maths. Now, you might or might not agree that something needs to be done about food advertising to children, but before you make up your mind, just bear this in mind. Children under five have difficulty separating program content from advertising. Children under eight have difficulty discerning the selling intent behind advertising and marketing messages. Now, you might recall a few years ago we had a bit of a barney in this country over the shock jocks and what we called cash for comment. Now, if you're concerned about cash for comment, well, ads for advertising to children can put the shock jocks to shame, and advert gaming can wipe the floor with them. Let's compare those broadcasting practices with advergaming. Failure to distinguish ads and editorial. Check. Failure to disclose the motivation for putting a product in a positive light. Check. And this is being directed at the most vulnerable people in our community. It's no surprise that about 15 years ago, Philip Adams likened what goes on with advertising to children to paedophilia, and he coined the phrase corporate paedophilia. Why? Because they prey on the innocence, credulity, and loyalty of children. And in fact, the corporate version of paedophilia can probably touch more lives of children than the sexual kind. And I would suggest parents are less equipped to address it. Now, obviously, it's not the Rudd government's intent to do anything about that. I think that's a shame. But if the community has a role in setting parameters for that, I think there's no point unless you address internet advertising, because it is just so powerful. I just wanted to say a few more words to those of you who are sitting there thinking, well, where are the parents in all of this? Shouldn't they be taking responsibility? There are all different kinds of parents. Some are better able to take responsibility. Some are better willing to take responsibility. What do we say to those children whose parents aren't willing or able to take responsibility? Do we throw them to the wolves? Do we say, well, just too bad for you? Well, we could do that. We wouldn't be a very nice society if we did, and we wouldn't be a very healthy society in 50 years when those children are running it. So please think about that, and please vote in favour of the negative. Thank you very much.
Right. Well, there's some stark choices for you. Now, I'm hoping that there are people here who would like to speak in this debate either for the motion or against it. If you would like to, there are four microphones located here, one on the other side, and in each corner. I'd encourage you to come down, and you have a minute, up to a minute, to speak for or against the motion, or you might want to make a comment or ask some kind of a question. So we'll start off. There's somebody up there at microphone number 3, I think it is. Would you like to give your name and begin?
Sure, thanks. I'll try and be quick. My name's Nina Fennell. I'm currently doing a PhD on child pornography and internet censorship, and I also sit on the board of the New South Wales Rape Crisis Centre, so I've had a lot of experience dealing with children who have been exploited. And with that hat on, I'd just like to say a couple of things. The first is that I really appreciated David Marr's comments that often these debates around censorship purport to be about children and vulnerability. But if they were actually about flesh and blood children, then they would acknowledge the competencies and voices of young people, and they would include those voices in these debates. The second thing that I'd say is that if we're actually going to talk about production of images involving children and how they circulate, the majority of those images are actually being produced by young people these days. It's called sexting. And yet what we're seeing now is, because of this conservative backlash, children in Australia and America more so are now being charged with production of child pornography for photographing their own bodies, which I think is really concerning. And finally, if we're going to talk about this issue of child exploitation, then we need to realise that the majority of it is actually going on in the family home. And to me, the real tragedy here is the fact that... The real tragedy is that those who claim to be protecting children are often guilty of exploiting the figure of the vulnerable child as a political pawn to advance their own agenda. And this is not about protecting children. It's about conservative agendas. Thanks.
OK, so you're speaking for the motion. Yes. That was a speech for the motion, is that correct? OK, is there somebody who wishes to speak against the motion?
Well,
that's not a problem. I just thought I'd at least ask, so I'd give people a chance. Are you speaking against the motion?
A question for the panel.
A question to the panel? OK, I'll take the question, then I'll go back up to the top. Thanks. So microphone one.
Simon, Michael Constant, my name. It's a question for the panel, which I suspect may be a Dorothy Dixer for the four affirmative speakers. But, look, it's a question about the effectiveness of a filter versus other means. And I guess my question to the panel, I'd be particularly interested in Alice's comments on this, with the resources that are put into implementing an entire new structure that's built around filtering the internet in a country, be better spent, do you think, on increasing the number of police and the resources that are available in the cybercrime unit in the AFP?
Okay, I'm just going to hold that for the moment. We'll come back to you. No, it's just because I want to get a few other people's voices, and then we'll come back to that question. So just pencil it in and get ready for a response. I take it you're speaking for the motion, so... possibly. Anyway, microphone 4, your name, please.
My name is Will Uther. I guess I have a question. I've forgotten if it's for or against now that I'm here.
If it's a question, it's neither.
Anti-filter side. All night you were saying we're not going to talk about a particular proposal, we're going to talk about censorship in general. And yet one of the issues I've had when trying to think about this debate is that the particular proposal that gets brought forward keeps changing, and often the arguments around it are different for different proposals. The argument for a voluntary, very broad filter for children is very different than the argument around a very specific but mandatory filter. And so I guess my question is, if you're going to argue for some sort of censorship, can you put forward one particular proposal that you think is good?
Okay. And microphone 2, and then we'll go back to the panel and come back to the floor. So, 2.
Rob McGregor. I wanted to know if the panel recalls a media story about one of the artists from the group Massive Attack, where a number of years ago he was a staunch dissident against the British government and a lot of its policies. And he was researching child pornography. And they made an example of him, publicised his name, yet the charges never continued. And ironically, he was in Australia at the time when he was, the charge quashed. But that would represent part of a bigger picture, which is a bit of a thread between last month's, this month's, and next month's debates. Unrepresentatives will. A million green voters not getting any representation in the House of Representatives in Australia, then making a policy from a religious petition and lobbying from religious groups to censorship and control the web. leading towards privacy and surveillance, which is probably the next level of the threat, which is ultimately going to lead to the next point, which is Internet 2, which is a construct of the US government where hundreds of institutions, companies, are going to control a new level of the web, which is a major issue for future surveillance and control.
Thank you. If you're at a microphone, rest assured, we'll come back to you. But look, there's two specific questions put here, and I'll ask whoever wants to answer, and then I'll come back for a response. One is to do with if you had the resources, what would you do with them? Would they be better spent off on policing or other things? And then a related question, I think, which is to do, can you, any of you, come up with a specific recommendation that you would support? So who wants to go?
Well, I'd actually like to point out that these questions address specifically the proposals here in Australia, and that has nothing whatsoever to do with the debate.
Okay, so that taken, the question was put, beyond anything in Australia, is there a particular proposal for censorship that you would support?
Well, can I start by perhaps saying that, to me, this is about the application of law. And it's about asking whether or not the law that we accept and we argue against, and we have parliaments that debate, that affect us offline every day, is equally applicable online. That's really what the question is. So, no, I can't actually argue for a particular specific censorship regime for the internet, because, as Kaiser said, that's not where our mind is at. The question we are asking, and the question we've been asked to address, which is why I think we would come to speak, is should the law apply online as reasonably or as irrationally as it's applied on a daily basis offline? So to answer the question about where I'd be putting resources, well, it wouldn't be in the clean feed internet filter. To me, it will fail. And I think the public opinion is that it would fail, and I think the technical opinion is that it would fail. That's not the question. The question is, should we be putting resources somewhere else? Yeah. Online crime enforcement in this country is not staffed or funded to the level it should. Not staffed and funded to the level of the activity that we actually undertake online. The number of accounts that we have and the number of unfortunate levels of victimisation that occurs. I would like to see more enforcement and more police dedicated to it. So I'm not arguing for the internet filter, and no one else is here. Yep. And nor are we arguing for political censorship. We're talking about the application of laws that we accept and are willing to debate and change over time that occur offline and whether they should occur online as well.
I think, David, I might throw to you and...
You will have observed, as we've observed, that there is no one up here willing to argue for the filter. And there is certainly no one on this side of the stage that believes that the internet is some kind of utopia beyond the reach of the law. The internet is policed, and it should be policed. I, as an author, particularly want Google to be stopped from stealing my books. And I'm sorry to have to bring that up in public. It's a little bit impolite, I know, but I'm not going to get a better opportunity. The law runs in the internet. I thought we were out here tonight because we were to debate a unique proposition being put to us by the Australian government, that they would attempt to apply to the internet the same censorship mechanism which they currently apply to film and television. Now, this is an attempt to apply the present system to the future world. It's completely hopeless. How many hours have Fresh Film have been uploaded to YouTube since we got into this hall tonight? Probably about 1,000 hours. There are 12 people working in Surrey Hills.
Okay, let's go back to the audience. We'll go a few comments from here that line up. So, microphone one.
My name is Luke. A quick fact about the internet. The largest amount of pornography is accessed by 12 to 17-year-olds. So I'm forward emotion, of course. Just a few facts about the internet. The reason that you shouldn't try to censor the internet is the same reason that crime will never be wiped out and that global warming and pollution is still going to be a big problem. It's in too many people's interest to keep the internet uncensored. It's in, you know, oil companies' interest to keep pollution going. It's in... I forgot my other point, but yeah. It's just going to be too hard to try and censor the internet because there are too many people who want to keep the internet uncensored for their reasons, whether it be illicit or legitimate.
So you're essentially saying it's futile, so why bother? Is that right?
Yes.
Just like global warming.
Just like global warming. So well, you can respond in a moment. Up the top there, microphone number four, please.
My name's Chris Johnson. I'd like to take up a point that David made and even Kaiser alluded to. We're not talking about now. We're talking about the future. We give the government the mechanism. What will they do in the future? And I've got a true example. I put up an assignment for university engineers. Within 4 days, I was notified it was on a site in Hong Kong and they wanted someone to write an answer so whichever student or students put it there could copy that answer and submit it. Those engineers are going to go out and build bridges, buildings, which may or may not collapse. Surely we should censor that. But if we do, where do we stop? And the answer is education, accountability, responsibility, and teach ethics in schools.
Okay. There's a few people who I hope are listening to that. Microphone two, please.
Thank you. Addressing the definition of the negatives. There's about 55 years that I've been associated with around politicians, observing politicians and governments. In that time, I've never seen anybody or any government that I would trust to tell me what I can and cannot see. None. As for 90-something percent spam, I am a heavy user of the net daily. I cannot remember when I last saw spam in my inbox. Thank you, Google. So, last point. There's a group in Surrey Hills that are watching all this damaging material. Are they being kept locked up so they can't damage society? And if they're not damaged, why are the rest of us going to be damaged? Thank you.
Okay. Microphone one. Your name, please.
Sorry, my name's Sam Dwyer. I didn't actually want to make a point. I just wanted to clarify a quick definition for people because I think this is an argument that's going to become very important over the next couple of months. The debate this evening has been about should government censor the internet, and the feed that we've been mostly discussing regarding from the government is actually for the web, and they're very separate concepts in this context, and it's really important that people recognise that web traffic is a minuscule amount of actual traffic compared to the amount of information that gets passed across the internet and would not be censored at all and cannot be censored by the government censor. That's...
Okay, that's a good point. Thank you for that. I'll come to you in a moment. Ross, I noted in Kaiser's speech that he referred to, and Google came up a few times through here, once in relation to India, and I just wondered whether or not you wanted to comment on that, because I think, Kaiser, you were making the claim that there is a degree of censorship by
Absolutely.
Google in India. Do you want to express a view about that?
Kaiser was quoting a colleague of mine, Nicole Wong, who's our Deputy General Counsel, and Nicole was making that comment, and what she was saying was that there are difficult issues. There are some categories like child pornography that I think we all agree have absolutely no place on the net. When we find it on any of our sites or come across it, we take it down immediately and we have a zero tolerance policy toward it. When you get beyond that, the issues become very difficult, and that's all that Nicole was saying. It may be abhorrent to some of us, but one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. And the old adage about one person's art being another person's trash is really true. And so the question becomes, whom do you want making that decision for you?
And just to draw you out, because another point that was made is, are you partly arguing that it is safer in some senses to have a private network owner make that decision for their own reasons than to put it into the hands of governments?
Absolutely. That's the core of it. Yeah, okay.
Absolutely. We believe that individuals should be empowered through education and with tools and left to make their own decisions about what they and their family and their children see on the net. It should not be in the hands of government.
Google, in this instance, is acquiescing in a form of internet censorship out of a realization that different cultures draw different lines around what is considered acceptable. And that's all I'm arguing. And if you accept that there are different cultures that do draw such lines, you must accept that in some instances, censorship is necessary.
But when you say acquiescing, are you saying that in this case, Google is
acquiescing to the
government. Acquiescing to the government of India,
that's
rather than it applying its own private standards.
That's correct.
Happens to match the government of India.
That's correct.
I should clarify that in every country in which we operate, we are required to abide by those laws. Now, that doesn't mean that we do that willingly. And in most cases, when we get a government request, we push back, and we push back very hard. And as you saw in China, sometimes when things get too difficult and we feel like we can't make a difference, we pull out, and we do that on principle. And now any businessman would have told you that Google is really stupid to have pulled out of China. You know, and I can assure you that that decision was not made for economic reasons. It was made out of principle.
Okay. We're going to go through. We've got enough time, I think, for four last speakers from the floor, and then we'll start wrapping up. So, microphone one, if you want your name, please.
Hi, my name's Ben Teal. I also have a sore throat, so I apologise for the croakiness.
Sounds very good.
Very rough. I don't know about you, but I've found the arguments for both the for and against side to be a little too specific rather than dealing with the question generally. Four seem to be focused a bit too much on the Australian or the Chinese or even the Indian regime, whereas the against seem to be a bit more focused on protecting the children. I want to try and do a pro-against line, but go a bit more general, so I'm going to take it away from the internet. Censorship involves preventing people from accessing it, so it might be, say, preventing the construction or the manufacturing of a certain prohibited substance, the distribution thereof, the ownership, the selling, the promoting. Let's go away from the internet. I can think of one thing off the top of my head. Let's do something like an illicit drug. Let's take methamphetamine. If you are discovered to be manufacturing in this country, you are shut down. The government will come in and remove your access to it. If you're trying to sell it to people, even if you own it, you're not allowed to access it. In a way, it is still a form of censorship. Now, let's do a hypothetical. Let's say that the Australian government can come up with a way...
Let's not do a hypothetical, because we're out of time.
All right.
But I think
let's say we don't have the bad side effects of blocking people's free speech.
No, I meant,
but only
really, let's not do a hypothetical.
All right, then.
Okay, thank you. No, we got the general idea. Thank you. Microphone two.
My name is Lindsay Cullen. The case in the negative made the comment a number of times that this is not about the government's filter, but instead that it was somehow about whether the government should have some measure of control over the internet. But the actual framing of the question was about the specific kind of control, which is censorship. I just wanted to make the comment that whatever censorship is, I think it's a form of control which focuses not on those who produce or distribute illegal material, but on those who consume something which may become illegal. It's therefore a form of control which is about the perspective of a crime being committed. It's a bit Minority Report, if you like, and I don't think that's a track we should be going down.
Thank you. A very helpful distinction there. Microphone one, your name, please.
My name is Adam Musa. I have a question for Mr. McGibbon. His argument focused a lot, he threw around the terms good and bad a lot. And what I would like to know is, on the internet, in his opinion, is there a direct correlation between good and bad and lawful and unlawful in the real world?
Okay, we'll just hold that question for his summing up. And no one up in there waiting? Yeah, okay, so I think you're going to be the last person speaking. Your name, please.
My name's Stephanie Smith, and I'd actually like to speak against, for the against side.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
We have talked about children, and they've been dismissed. I don't think we can dismiss our children at all. They're the ones that are the victims in a lot of this stuff. The perpetrators, yes, we should catch them and put them in jail and do whatever, but the reality is most of them will never be caught. The trouble with the internet is that people have webcams at home, you've got mothers who are vulnerable, who are being groomed, and they will exploit their children, even unwittingly. It's just the nature of what the internet is these days.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Now, two things are going to happen. One is it's your opportunity to vote. I'll just remind you that you should have a voting slip. If you are still undecided, don't worry about tearing it up. When the ballot box comes, put it in whole. Either, though, if you're for, just tear it in half, put the for in, or against. As you vote, a range of speakers, all of them will speak, but in this order, we'll have 2 minutes now to sum up. And we'll start with you, Ross, if you want to come back. You might respond to a question, make some closing remarks. So we can just listen, please. Ross Lajeunesse, your 2 minutes begins now.
Thanks. I wanted to respond to the argument that this is not about Australia's filtering proposal, and that I just wanted to say that, you know, while Google opposes the Australian proposal, it's important to note that the fact that this public debate is happening is itself a testament to how different Australia is and how special it is in this part of the world and throughout the rest of the world. And it's a debate that wouldn't occur in many parts of the world. So while we view comparisons of Australia's filtering proposal to China, for example, as ludicrous and inappropriate, I also worry that the government's plans to enforce a mandatory filtering proposal or filtering regime could legitimize government censorship elsewhere. And in fact, we've seen in China at least one ministry post a press release about the Australian proposal on its website as a way of making that argument. And our fear is that the Australian proposal is a first step away from free expression and a free and open internet.
Thank you. Kaiser, sorry.
I would urge you to remember that this is not a proxy vote about your sentiments about the Rudd administration's proposed clean feed. This has nothing to do with that. This is a question in the abstract over whether a government, not the Australian government, but any government, under any circumstance, has the right, because of the complexities of its own historical experience, because of the realities of the economy on the ground, because of it, the problems that it faces in society. We are not all equal, and it is not condescending to say that there are some people who are, because of their history, less ready for the sorts of freedoms that we're talking about here. If you can even think of one instance in which it's possible that the right thing to do would be to control the internet, to save lives, to actually save lives, then you must cast your vote against the proposition.
David Maher, your 2 minutes.
Yeah. I've been writing about and talking about censorship for about the last 15 years. I've got a very personal reason for doing this, because I was an articled law clerk about 30 years ago in the Portnoy's complaint case, and we thought we had won freedom for this country, and it still, of course, keeps creeping. Censorship keeps creeping back. In the time that I've been writing about censorship, thinking about it, arguing about it, I've become fascinated by the notion that you can tell what people are really on about by looking at the arguments that make no headway with them, the unanswerable arguments that make no headway. And the unanswerable argument about the filter, and I'm not talking about the policing of the net, because as you've heard, I support the policing of the net, but the unanswerable argument about the filter is that it doesn't work. Why would you go to these lengths to put in place a system which even Stephen Conroy, with his trademark pained look, admits isn't going to work?
Why do you do it? Now, I think the answer is this, that this is an area where governments are happy to make decent gestures. That they don't work is irrelevant. It's a politically attractive, decent gesture. And it comes largely from not entirely at all, but comes largely after campaigning from the churches. Now, the churches are into decent gestures as well, of course. And they're not into liberty. After all, Christians have signed up as followers of the most powerful thing ever imagined, the Lord God. They are not on the side, on the whole, of liberty. Some are, most aren't. This is a gesture. This government is going down the track of a gesture. A gesture that could turn against the people of Australia once that mechanism is there. It will never work to achieve its aim, but it might work against us in the most horrible way.
Thank you. Alistair McGibbon.
Well, I've said it a few times, I'm going to say it again. This is not about the internet filter and the politics surrounding it. The regulation and laws pertaining to the production, distribution and possession of certain dangerous and illegal material is not a new notion on or offline. In fact, censorship is age old and for very good reason. Australian government should have the ability to try and preserve some form of minimum social values on the internet because it's just an extension of what we do offline. We do need to protect innocent people. We do need to protect the unassuming against the excesses of criminals. It's what we expect offline, and it's what we should demand online. Don't fall into the dumbed-down, simplistic lumping of Australia into some group of totalitarian regimes, and to hear that this debate is about political censorship. It's not what it's about. It's not what it's about. This is about whether or not laws could and should in some way be enforced on the internet as they are offline. It's actually about protecting people. It's not about hurting people and hurting their political views or controlling those. Think about that as you leave tonight. Too late for your vote, but it's not about the politics of the internet filter. Sure.
Anthony Lowenstein.
Thank you. It's important to note from the beginning that none of us on this side of the aisle, sort of aisle, have said that Australia is going down the path of China or Iran or Saudi Arabia. It's not. And I think to compare those two is silly and probably even obscene. But the role of government and how that government operates is the point, because we aren't talking in the abstract. We are talking about a situation of how will a government, say the current Australian government, implement their plan. It needs to be transparent. Governments are not benign. And when a point is made, as Alistair just said, that we're not talking about politics, he's right. We're not today, but we're seeing already in Europe conversations about banning political content. This conversation might start tomorrow or next week or next month. A point was made before in one of the talks about, for example, the issue of neo-Nazis online or extreme race hate, and this is probably a debate for another time, but I think it's important to say that there's an important distinction to be made here between the argument of allowing certain views online and positions that are advocating violence. Now, you could argue that neo-Nazis, through definition, are suggesting violence, but my point is that this is a conversation that needs to be had. Is a neo-Nazi website, should that be banned? I would argue, as someone who is Jewish, a human being, but I'm Jewish, I think that's an important point, that I would have an issue potentially with the neo-Nazi site being banned. Not because I agree with it, I fundamentally oppose it, but it's about saying, do we feel comfortable with those sort of views excluded? Because maybe governments will exclude my view next, believe it or not. Rational debate is important, it's vital. And the truth is that we have a government, unfortunately, under the wonderful Stephen Conroy, who seems to want to smear critics of this debate. We've been accused not us directly, but people who are being critical of the filter of supporting pedophilia. He said it many, many times. So if we want to have a rational debate and say, how should governments manage the web, and we, on the three of us, all say authorities have a role to manage the internet, but we're talking about practical realities, and the truth is that we should not trust openly a government to do that for us. Debate has to happen rationally now. Thank you.
Elizabeth Hansley.
Me again. Hi. I'd like to address this idea of bracket creep. I don't understand how you can have bracket creep in an open society where you have a democratically accountable government and a very well-informed populace. We have a category that is RC, refused classification. It's right there on the website for everybody to look at, and I doubt it's going anywhere soon. So we can all go and see what that category is. If the government wants to change that category, it has to go through the usual processes. And in fact, it's a very difficult process because they have to get all the state attorneys general to agree. So it would not be something that would be done in the dead of night while nobody was looking. There will be no bracket creep without all of us getting a chance to have a say. Second thing I would like to say briefly is I really would like to know how Anthony is so sure that all of these different laws in these different oppressive regimes have had absolutely zero effect. How do we know that heroin abuse would not have been even worse if it hadn't been for that change? It's a very easy thing to say, zero effect, but I think we need to wait for proof. Last thing I would just like to say on freedom of speech generally, there's a deep irony at the heart of freedom of speech that's really come out tonight. When we protect freedom of speech, we give speech a trump card. We elevate it above everything else, every other aspect of human society, human endeavour, that we are willing for governments to regulate, but somehow speech is different. We elevate that, but at the same time, we deny it any consequence. We say, sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me, that kind of thing. We can't have it both ways. If speech is so powerful and so important, it needs to be on the table as something that we, as a society, can talk about controlling and regulating. And that's exactly what censorship is. You might call it censorship. We call it civilization. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
That's a ringing kind of line, isn't it? You might call it censorship, we call it civilization.
With that?
Now, the tellers are busily counting the vote at the moment. Let me just tell you a little bit about what happens to the material that's been recorded. Big Ideas on ABC One will feature excerpts from the debate on the following Tuesday, as I understand it, at around 11 a.m. Then the debate's likely to be played in full at the same time on the next day, the Wednesday. In addition to that, you can find podcasts that can be downloaded from the ABC website. For those of you who like to review these things on radio, then ABC Radio National will play this just after 6 p.m. news the following day, I think it is, so Thursday next week, and it may even be played, I think, on a Sunday evening. The next debate here is going to be on the topic, Better More Cameras Than More Crime. So it is, as somebody suggested, a bit of a theme around civil liberties and our safety in this case. And if you happen to be in Melbourne on the 15th of June, this will be a very interesting debate, I think, on the topic that Australia has not escaped its racist past. We've got Robert Mann down there, the President of the Indian Students Federation, a number of very interesting speakers, Tanvir Ahmed, addressing that fascinating topic. I think the votes have been done. Just before I read these, I'd just like to thank a few people and then come to the vote. Deb Richards, who produced the series, Anne Goldner, who manages the production, the staff and management of the City Recital Hall at Angel Place, volunteers who've conducted the ballot, the editor and management of the Sydney Morning Herald, Clemengers for their advertising, the Mayor, Aldermen and officers of the City of Sydney, and the Managing Director and staff of the ABC. But particularly tonight, would you join with me in thanking our panel, Ross LaJeunesse, David Maher, Anthony Lowenstein, Kaiser Crowe, Alistair McGibbon and Elizabeth Hansley. Now, where's John Rothney Jones? Where are you? You here? All right, just stand up for a second, thank you. No, stand up, quick. You're going to hold everybody up and they'll get very annoyed with you. John Rothney Jones is a name you've probably heard mentioned on a couple of occasions. He's a partner in us in presenting the IQ2 debates. He and Delia are about to set sail for other places, so this is the last time that he'll be attending one of the IQ2 debates in Sydney, at least for the foreseeable future. So would you join with me in thanking him for being there? We wish you well wherever you happen to be, John. Well, the results. The pre-debate poll. Now, as I give you these results, remember there are a couple of ways of looking at this. There's either the absolute figures themselves in percentages or there's the size of the swing. So before the debate, you know, it sometimes offers solace to either side that doesn't get it. The debate, before the debate took place, for was 72.4%, against 15.3%, and 12.3% only was undecided. So that's quite a small number of undecided for a debate of this kind. After the debate, undecided, 5.5%, against 24%, and for 70.5%. I declare the motion carried.